Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Lucinda Rouse.
And I'm Andy Ricketts. Each week we bring you half an hour of discussion and debate about the important goings-on in the charity world. This week we'll be joined by the fundraising historian Marina Jones, who's going to be talking to us about the history of fundraising, including a tale about a tower that was built by allowing people to eat butter and the world's first charity single, which might not be exactly what you think.
But before we get to that, let's talk about some of the news that has been passing over the Third Sector news desk in the past few days.
Yeah, and the first thing I wanted to talk about was ActionAid UK. They've appointed three interim chief executives, which I think is pretty unusual for any charity, not least a major charity of its size. People might know that ActionAid UK last year appointed Halima Begum to take over. She joined in July, but then in December, she announced that she was leaving to take up the top job at Oxfam GB.
Of course, yes.
So the charity has now said that they've appointed three of their current directors, Tara Ghazi, Shada Odupelu and Hannah Bond, and they're going to run the organisation in the meantime.
Yes, like you say, we've heard certainly in the past year or so a couple of organisations that have got job shares with two chief executives, but three is something new altogether. So do we have any idea how this is going to work in practice?
So the three co-leaders will perform their new leadership role in addition to their existing director roles. Mm-hmm. So I think what's going to happen is they're going to have a responsibility in each of the areas they already work in, probably plus a few other bits that they don't already cover. And the charity said that the three of them will then be responsible for jointly making decisions on the overall strategic direction of the charity, which I think is going to be potentially where you might get some disagreement or argument. So it'd be interesting to see how that works in practice with the three of them working together.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see if they share any learnings from this experience slash experiment. Do we know how long the arrangement's going to be in place?
Well, what the charity have said is that they're actually not starting the process of appointing a full-time permanent chief executive because they basically want to see how this works. When I asked the charity about this, they said they want to ensure that we focus on our exciting new interim leadership plans, giving the co-chief executives the space to build Action UK into a more feminist, anti-racist organisation that delivers on our mission for women and girls' rights and social justice. So I think that's really interesting. They obviously want to give this a good go. This is not just like a 5-minute opportunity. This is something that they're going to be doing for quite some time because, as we know, recruiting a permanent chief executive for an organisation normally takes quite a long time. So I think this could be, this is going to be several months at least while this arrangement is in place.
Very interesting. And have you seen much discussion within the sector off the back of this announcement? Do you think charities are going to look to copy this idea?
I think it will be quite unusual at the moment because, I mean, you mentioned at the top that we've already seen some other charities appointing co-chief executives. Friends of the Earth, for example, is one example that we've talked about on this podcast. But I think it's going to remain, for the time being, an unusual arrangement, partly because you're going to need to get three people. If you want to appoint three co-chief executives, but the practicalities of that are quite difficult to work out. So I don't see lots of other charities copying it immediately, but it is an interesting idea that organisations can bear in mind for the long term.
What else has been keeping the news team busy?
Well, another thing that I just wanted to pick up was maybe a slightly more positive story. We've had quite a lot of bad news, it seems, recently. Lots of stuff going on that is not good for people to talk about. But most of our listeners will probably know that last week was Red Nose Day. Obviously, it's a massive telethon that they have every year now. But one of the things that's been happening with Red Nose Day is that the total since 2015, the total has been going down. Every year, well, not every year because it was only operating every 2 years until 2021, but it's been going down and down and down. This year, though, the on the night total went up to £38.6 million by the end of the television show on Friday night, which was compared with £31.9 million at the same stage last year. So it's a 20% increase on the previous year, which I think in the current economic climate is a fantastic result.
Yeah. Any idea what could have caused that spike?
Well, I think it's fair to say that no two red nose days are created equally. And this one had some unusual perks in the sense that it was Lenny Henry's last Red Nose Day as a host. Obviously, he's been presenting it for 40 years. He's been involved right from the start, and they made a big deal of that. But I think the fact that there's been such a large rise, you know, it's not just a tiny 1 or 2%. 20% is pretty big. In the current climate where fundraising is difficult, and off the back of a situation where appeals like this have been seeing a steady decline for years and years and years, I think it's a really good result for Comic Relief, and hopefully shows that charities are still remaining pretty resilient despite some of the, or many of the, closure stories that we've been seeing recently.
Fingers crossed. Now, just before we get onto our main discussion for this week, we'd like to play you a trailer for our new podcast project.
When you're seeing this scale of need and this scale of response, you have to question, what do we want for our society? What is our social contract?
The point that's really important thinking about charity as it is now in the UK is the Victorian era, because that's where we have the model of charity as a way of the haves essentially giving to the have-nots.
There are around 200,000 charities in the UK. Some are run by a single person, others are multi-million pound operations, and they address almost every area of need you can think of. But it is a world with a complicated past.
You can really trace back the history of racism and the charity sector to colonialism and imperialism. When we look at historical figures who, you know, were philanthropists, who were giving money to schools, and like really being seen in our country as these philanthropic, benevolent beings, and at the same time were prolific slave traders.
And charities today are wrangling with a whole set of other challenges.
Go and help the person directly. Don't do it through a charity. It's much more rewarding when you help the person directly.
Because you were dealing with Oxfam, you were dealing with a great British institution. It was a household name. It was very much part of the fabric of our society. It was going to be a huge story, a huge story.
So in a world where the need is greater than ever,
we probably were providing 10 years ago 50,000, 60,000 emergency food parcels, whereas last year food banks in our network provided just under 3 million emergency food parcels, 1 million of which were for children.
But the landscape for doing good has shifted dramatically. What does the future look like for charities?
Charities can't assume that they're the only game in town anymore. There are all of these other options.
I'm Lucinda Rouse, and this is The End of Charity.
Moving on to the main part of this week's episode, how much do you think about the voluntary sector workers of generations past? A lot of time has been spent throughout history documenting the work and contributions of great philanthropists, but really not so much those who asked for the money for good causes. Fortunately, a project has been underway to remedy that and to place the story of fundraising as a profession in a broader social and cultural context. And we're delighted to be joined by Marina Jones, Deputy Development Director at the English National Opera. She's also been leading on this project with the fundraising think tank Ragari. Hi, Marina.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us today to discuss something which I think is absolutely fascinating. Could we jump straight in? And could you please tell us, why is it so important for the fundraisers of today to consider their history?
Well, I think there's always that famous quote, isn't there? Those that don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. So I think if we don't know about our history as fundraisers and what's worked, what hasn't worked, how we've evolved and how we've got to where we are today, then I think there is a danger that we make the same mistakes other people have made in the past, that we don't learn from what other people have tried and tested and sometimes been incredibly successful with, or may have failed completely and are wasting the valuable time and resources of our charities if we don't learn the best lessons from the past as well as thinking about it. I think quite often as fundraisers, how we approach history in our organisations can be, oh, we tried that once in 1983 and it didn't work, so we're never going to go anywhere near that again. Or on the other side, we've been doing it since 1983, and if it isn't broke, don't fix it. So we kind of have two very kind of different attitudes to the past and what we've tried and what we've learned. But with this Regare project, it's been fascinating looking back to Roman times, to Greek times, to medieval and all bits of history, and looking at what we can learn from those fundraisers in the past, and also just how hidden some of those histories are. Because as you say, we focus on what the fundraisers did and the libraries, the buildings, the changes in society that they achieved, but not on how they did it, what was working and why it worked.
That's really interesting. Even just what you said there, Marina. I mean, I think most people listening to this would probably think that traditional fundraising maybe started in the Victorian period, but you've mentioned the Greek and Roman times. Were there fundraisers even then?
Yeah, I mean, there are some great examples. I mean, Regare has worked very closely as well with the Sophie Project, which has a lot of stories of innovation and inspiration from Roman times. So you see Moses raising money for the temple in the Bible. You see lessons in other bits of biblical and Roman history about how society was organized and how civic games or plays were put on in Roman and Greek times, and how the money was raised for that and organized. And then sort of moving through into kind of Christian church and how cathedrals were constructed. One of my favorite stories about cathedrals, you see a lot of the things that we see now with modern campaigns. You could sponsor a brick, get your name in a window. You could also sponsor one person's day. But there was a great thing during Lent, which we're currently in at the moment. People in Toulouse were not able to eat butter, and they're big fans of butter in that bit of Normandy in France. And the bishop said, if you give a donation to my cathedral fund, I'll let you eat butter during Lent. So there is now a tower of that cathedral, which is built entirely because of the people that made those donations during Lent, and it's still called the Butter Tower.
That's amazing. And going back to what you were saying at the beginning about the need to consider practices of the past in order to not make the same mistakes today, you work in the fundraising profession yourself. Have you come across any particular examples that have stuck in your mind as you've been doing this research into things that, oh gosh, if people who were working in fundraising today could only think back to this, then our situation would be a lot better?
I think it's odd because you see some practices and you think, oh, we wouldn't do it like that nowadays, and that's probably quite a good thing. There was an American missionary fundraiser called Dwight L. Moody. And as you do with a big fundraising dinner, you have all your people lined up and who's going to come, and you're going to make the big ask. And their key supporter didn't turn up for the dinner. So then he basically turned up at his home. And sort of that kind of, you know, there's a bit of fundraising, which is always an elegant stalking of finding your connections with people and bringing them there. But he literally went to this person's house because they didn't show up at the dinner, and insisted that they should come and be on the platform with him. And so, I won't ask you for money, but just come and be on the platform with me at the next big event, because, you know, just your presence there will be really, really important. And then so this gentleman reluctantly agreed, but then he was sort of shamed into making a gift because he was on the platform. So there are sort of things you think, well, we like to know a lot about our donors, but we don't want to follow them home. And, you know, that kind of undue pressure to make a gift. We wouldn't do that now. So I think there are different sort of ethical understandings of what we would do and how we would approach that practice, which we see, as well as things that you just think, well, of course, you know, we've always done it like that. And isn't that a great way that we raise money?
Yeah, it does sound like that would certainly fall foul of the code of fundraising practice these days. But in terms of the public perception of fundraisers, how would you say that's kind of tracked over the decades and centuries? Because obviously there's quite a few people these days who regard fundraisers quite unfavourably. Has that always been the case?
I think, yeah, we do really see that thread of suspicion, really, of fundraisers and what they're doing it for and why they're doing it. I think a lot of it comes down to our sort of suspicion of people with bits of money and how we trust other people with money and to do the right things. The first sort of legislation we see in terms of fundraising and regulating the profession comes in 1215 at the Fourth Lateran Council. Pope Innocent III put in place various legislations about how people were asking for money and what fundraisers should do. It also includes guidance on what fundraisers should wear. So they shouldn't be ostentatiously dressed. They should look like the normal people. They shouldn't be, yes, fancy. They shouldn't be consorting in taverns and various other things. But one of the reasons that that legislation had to come in was because of the perceived misuse of that fundraising tactic, and that you had people going out and raising money who weren't legitimately part of that church collecting thing, who had false letters or faked letters from fake bishops to say they should be there collecting money. So that's one of the earliest things. So I think that suspicion that people are collecting money and it's not going where it ought to go is a sort of probably a very just part of our human nature, that we're a bit suspicious of who looks after money and what actually happens to that money.
You've already described some great anecdotes. It seems a bit unreasonable that fundraisers shouldn't be doing their work in taverns. Surely that would be the place when people might be feeling at their most generous at a certain time of night. How about specific personalities that you've come across in your research? Are there any favourites that you could share with us?
Yeah, there's a couple of favourite stories. I think one thing I find really interesting when you delve into the history of it is a lot of the time you see these practices, and we do them nowadays, but we do them nowadays with a much deeper and richer understanding of the kind of the psychology behind it, the neuroscience, the behavioral economics behind it. And one of my favorite anecdotes and stories is from Peterborough Cathedral, where Catherine of Aragon, former Queen of England, is buried. During the Commonwealth and Protectorate, Oliver Cromwell's troops destroyed her tomb because she was royalty and they were very anti-royalty. And the tomb fell into disrepair. The tombstone itself became part of one of the deans of Peterborough's summer house. But in 1883, a young girl called Catherine decided to appeal to the nation to resurrect the tomb and start a fundraising campaign for all the Catherines of England to make a contribution. So using that name recognition of, if you're a Catherine, you should care about this other Catherine. And it was picked up by a duchess, Duchess Catherine Cavendish, who then put it in the Times, and it became this big campaign across the Commonwealth with little Catherines and big Catherines all giving gifts to restore Catherine of Aragon's tomb, which it was done in 3 years, and they reopened it and it's still there in the cathedral. But what's really interesting is now, with our better understanding of the neuroscience behind that, there's something called the cocktail party effect and the name effect. So you are more likely to give to a cause that has your name initial in it. So there's some research done on hurricanes, and if your name began with M, you were 30% more likely to give a donation to Hurricane Mitch because of that name effect. But to see that working in the 1880s, before we had any understanding of that psychology and how that was working inside our brains, but to know that now, there's a research done in the late 1990s, that we do behave in that way, and that how we could perhaps use that to inspire our donors if we were doing a campaign, to use that name letter effect to make them feel that connection with something, or that it's going on subconsciously, irrationally, inside our brains, and that is working as we make those appeals. So I think that's just a fascinating sort of deep innate understanding as humans of how to react with other humans, that the appeal of Catherine's to other Kates and Catherine's in Victorian England actually has sort of deep scientific proof that that is an effective way to raise money.
You've talked a lot, obviously, about a huge period of time here. Are there any particular periods that you would say that have significantly influenced where we are now in terms of fundraising than any other period?
Yeah, I mean, I think as fundraisers, we love stories, and we love to try and simplify things into stories. And too often, I think the history of fundraising gets lumped into, here are some great men, and it's usually men who did a thing, and that this suddenly kind of catapulted things forward. I think in terms of a more socio-cultural economic understanding, most of these things become more gradual and more influenced. I think the Victorian period, there were a lot of jumps forward. During that time, there were 500,000 women working informally and formally in fundraising. And I think a lot of the establishment of those female-led subscription charities that worked particularly around education and health were setting the building blocks in place for the suffrage movement to be such a success, because they replicated the models that they'd used on prison reform, on missionary societies and other Victorian elements like that. to really embed a professionalism into the suffrage movement and how they organised themselves going into that. But I think all through the Victorian period, you really see what fundraisers have always done and embrace technology and new technology that comes out. So you see, you know, merchandise, you see, there's a great example of a Rudyard Kipling poem that got set to music and became the first charity single. So we might think Live Aid was the first charity single. But in 1898, The Absent-Minded Beggar was the first charity single, which included the line, pass the hat for your credit's sake and pay, pay, pay. So very much a kind of fundraising message kind of core into the song. So you've got the ability to be able to use that, sell that as a record. But they also made handkerchiefs, so you could buy a sort of memorial handkerchief, and you see the use of kind of technology and sort of associated products with your charity. So really about that brand identity, that you have the handkerchief, you have the crockery, you have other things that are really showing your identity and your support. So using all of those new technologies to support fundraising, there's a huge sort of swathe, particularly sort of Salvation Army using the very kind of earliest kinds of photocopier. So if you look at the letters, and I've been to the archive there, they're in a sort of light blue. So it looks like it's been written in ink rather than it being looking like a kind of cheap photocopy of what you might expect. So, you know, the fundraiser's test, or, you know, the test you always get told, you know, lick your finger and see if it's real, if it's real ink. It really looks like someone's handwriting, but it's copied in such a way that it feels personal. And the advances in printing at that point, I think we really see the professionalisation and the mass mailing emergence of things in fundraising.
Gosh, so mass mailings back to Victorian times. And how significant have women been in the fundraising profession? And did you find it difficult to unearth stories about women fundraisers in particular compared to what had been documented about the great works of men?
Yeah, I mean, I think the simplified version of some fundraising history is that it involves a couple of great men coming along and transforming what was happening. But I think the fact that we have 500,000 women in Victorian England working semi-professionally in fundraising shows the sort of the dominance of women there. I think then you also get into big issues about how our history is recorded and how fundraising history in particular is recorded. And if you haven't got things written down, if you haven't got things recorded, I mean, Victorians were quite super keen on, you know, taking minutes, having accounts and various other things. So there is a lot there. One of the challenges is it's not always studied, and fundraising, because it hasn't had an academic practice particularly developed in terms of people studying it. Things like the suffrage movement and other things get studied for feminist history, for economic history, and different lenses are put on that. But it hasn't been examined purely from that fundraising lens and what it can tell us about the development of fundraising. The other really fascinating woman is Madame C.J. Walker, who was America's first billionaire. She was African-American woman. She developed hair care products for African-American women. But she was a fundraiser and a philanthropist, and she really wanted to imbue her employees with a sense of civic duty and that they had a duty of philanthropy. We talk nowadays often about having a culture of philanthropy through our whole organisations and that everyone is involved in making fundraising a success. She had a school that taught other hair care workers how to sell the products, how to use the products, but also had philanthropy and civic duty in the curriculum of the school and how they worked. So there was an understanding and an expectation of that. But one of the challenges with some of this is under the Jim Crow laws in America, there wasn't the right to association. Literacy among African-American people was really discouraged. So trying to have evidence of some of these things is really challenging. And it's the history is written by the victors or those with power and the money and the resources to keep those archives and to store them securely, to look after them. So there's a fascinating book about Madame C.J. Walker, which has been written, which really sort of elevates her position, her influence across the community, both in terms of how she raised money herself, how she was a philanthropist, and how she encouraged others to be there. But we're working with what we have, which is always the challenge for the historian of what is left behind. How do you then assess what is left behind and use the lens of today to see what does that tell us? And obviously, you know, we have our bias of today and how we're seeing that information and how we're interpreting it and how we're able to use it to help think about our fundraising, how we approach our fundraising, the ethos, the ethics, the approach, the psychology behind it.
And I just wondered, on that subject, I just wondered if we look forward maybe 100, 200 years, how you think historians will view this period of fundraising?
Well, I think one of the challenges will be, what are we going to leave them to look at? What are the resources and the archive that we might leave behind? A lot of trusts and foundations, not all of them, but people do catalogue their assets and put them in archives. I think charities in general, because we're, you know, financially, we don't have a lot of money and archive teams or departments don't exist in very many places. What are we as charities leaving for future people to look at, whether that's people in our organisation looking at, you know, the 2024 Christmas appeal or something? We're not very good at leaving the information there. So I think we need to be better at being able to archive those things and to record what's working. I think fundraising can be a really hard thing to archive because some of fundraising is, you know, the direct mail letter or the legacy brochure or the video, the legacy video on your website. But a lot of fundraising, particularly high net worth individuals, major donors, you know, the fundraising happens in the coffee, in the conversation, in the pause after you just asked for £1 million and you're waiting to see if they're going to say yes to that or if they're going to keep having a conversation with you. So yes, how will we think about fundraising? I think we'll have what we have now, that there is a bit of, when we look at the history, there's nothing new under the sun. There's a lot of things that we've always done and we will continue to do. And a lot of the attitude and approach that we have in terms of grabbing onto the latest technology and thinking, how do we use that in the best possible way to inspire more people to be more generous? And I think those sorts of trends will always be there. And then I'm sure we will look back in the way that there are certain things that we've come across in this Regare project and go, oh, that's very strange. We wouldn't now put a pig in a wheelbarrow and get sponsored to run along for 2 miles. Or we wouldn't train a parrot to say, put some money in the dish. We, you know, there are different sort of cultural things that we wouldn't do. And I think also what's interesting is our understanding of charity evolves and what is a charitable thing. There are traditional things, but pirates' ransoms or unmarried ladies were considered to be, you know, charitable endeavours. And I don't think, well, we're not raising money now for many pirates' ransoms or for unmarried women to be married so that they're not lonely or single and, you know, a threat to society. So what perhaps is even considered charitable will perhaps evolve with time. And then it was sort of, why was everyone worrying about this? I mean, the other thing, certain diseases, you know, we find the cure and therefore certain charities will cease to exist.
So many interesting things to think about there. So just as a final question, not many charities, if any at all, will have an archive department. As a historian yourself, what would you like to see charities doing today to preserve knowledge of what is being done for people to look back on?
I think there are some that is about internal conversations and sharing the history. There's a lot of really fascinating data about the power of nostalgia in fundraising campaigns and that it can be a really useful tool. I think we see it a lot at the moment. There's Cadbury's Chocolate are celebrating 200 years and there's a lot of nostalgia-led pieces looking at how important that chocolate might have been throughout your family life. And we see that with some successful campaigns, particularly around legacies, but not always. But connecting to the history of the charity is a really useful and powerful tool for fundraisers to use. So in terms of keeping archives and being there, I think it's about celebrating it internally with staff, the history of how certain things have been done. I think it's using it proactively in campaigns to connect audiences and supporters to your cause, because many have been involved for many years, and the nostalgia factor is a really important way to keep and build that loyalty. And I think it's about finding ways to celebrate and explore that. The Ragari History Project is building a big timeline of the history of fundraising, and it will become an open source resource that people can add their history in. So to look at adding campaigns that have been particularly successful, it's not just about firsts, it's just sort of also exploring and collating all of that. So it's a useful thing to be able to explore your history, to celebrate it, and to be able to use it to think about how it informs you as a fundraiser, but also your charity, because fundamentally, a lot of the time, the mission and the vision have always been the same, and the way it's been articulated through decades or even centuries of work helps you have a greater understanding of that call to action that ignites supporters.
Brilliant. So if people do want to learn more, can they go onto the Ragari website to take a look at what's out there at the moment?
Yeah, if you go on the Ragari website, we've published 2 out of the 3 chronological history timelines, going from 1500 to 1899 and 1899 up to the current date. There are going to be some thematic ones, and we're working at filling in the gaps from 1499 to the beginning of time, because that is a harder area to find some of those examples. But we're finding lots and adding as many as we can. So yes, if you look at the Ragari website, you'll be able to delve into the timeline.
Great. And we will include a link to that in the show notes to this episode. Marina Jones, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week. Next week, we'll be joined by Divya O'Connor, Chief Executive of the Sherry Blair Foundation for Women. Please do listen to episode 1 of The End of Charity if you haven't already. And for today, thank you to our guest Marina Jones and our producer Nav Powell.